Welcome to Lesbian Nation. Tonight we're starting off with a song by Roberta Cossey called Women Like Me, after which we'll have an interview with Sydney Abbott and Barbara Love. This is an interview with Sydney Abbott and Barbara Love, who just wrote a book that you're all going to run out and buy right away as soon as it hits your booksellers. And it's called Sappho Was a Right-On Woman. And who's publishing it?
Stein and Day.
And what outrageous price are they getting for it?
$6.95.
I think Barbara didn't allow for inflation, because I think that in the last year it went up from $6.95 to $7.95.
What were you going to ask? That's why we wrote the book.
she hasn't asked anything yet.
No, seriously. How did you get into writing it? You know, how did you get started on this particular thing?
Well, actually, I was talking to Kate Nolan on the phone one day, and she said Vivian Gornick had a large collection of about 20 pieces coming out, which has been published as Woman in Sexist Society. And she said that she regretted the fact that there wasn't a lesbian piece in there. And at the time, initially, we thought we would try to find someone else to write that piece. And there was only a month until the deadline, and so we realized that, at least as journalists, we could try to make the deadline. So we did write a piece for that. Then what happened was just sort of natural after that. In other words, we had a lot of ideas which didn't get expressed in the piece, and we had been in the movement, as Martha knows, for over a year at that time. So we put together an outline, and a couple of people in the movement really helped us from the very beginning. Nath Rock Hill, and she introduced us to George Caldwell. And we did have an agent, but it was really a kind of movement thing from the beginning, I think.
Well, you know, at that time when we did that piece, I was very much into letting the world know what we were doing, and I was encouraging you to write and Rita Mae, and at that time it wasn't the thing that people wanted to do. They wanted to relate to other publications.
Well, at that point, I was into writing for Underground Press.
Yeah, right. I know you were at that time. And at that time, I wanted to work and reach a whole lot of people, realizing the compensations and so on that would have to be made working with the media and the establishment. But I really felt that was important somehow. And a lot of people could have written this book, I think, people that have thought about it a lot and worked in the movement and have a new direction in thinking to bring to people. We did it, but I don't think that does it. I mean, a lot of people could have done this, and I think there'll be more books to come that are delve in more thoroughly on the concepts that we touched on. It's not the last word on any concept. I think there's so much more to be said on the lesbian mother and on psychology, on all the things that we touched on. But I do think it provides a direction for the people outside the movement.
What used to be called the seminal work, and now I guess we can call ovarian.
Oh, right. That's good. That's great.
This is the ovarian age. If people look carefully at the acknowledgments and at the preface and at the dedication, and also at the way the book is constructed, it really is, was created by a number of people, probably most importantly by our experiences with other people during 2 years in consciousness raising with two different groups during that time. I think, in a way, I'm not apologizing for having our names on the book because we worked like hell. In other words, the only thing we did that was different than a lot of the other people whom we acknowledge and mention and discuss was take a year of our lives and do nothing but that book. That's the only thing that was different. And I think that's partly what Barbara meant when she said other people could have written it. But we are very, very deeply aware, in a way, about how many people participated in this. It's very moving to me.
Getting into that conflict in a very deep way and trying to explore it was, really a heavy emotional experience. I mean, that conflict, we really lived it when we were writing about it. When we were writing about the conflict in our lives as gay people and the oppression and so on. I mean, it was, we had to get into our gut to explore what was going on, it was a really heavy emotional thing. I mean, it wasn't easy.
All right, let me just finish one point, because Martha has, I'm sure, a stirring question coming up. But and that is that one of the big debates we had was whether to write it in the first person or the third person, because actually we lived through being in the movement most of the experiences in the book, even things that we tell in a very repertorial fashion in the third person. But it was a very, very heavy decision, because I think it requires a tremendous amount of discipline to write in the first person. And also, we wanted to write the book together, and that would have made kind of artificial splits between, who was speaking now and who was speaking in another paragraph. So we finally did decide on the third person.
There's information in there about other people whose lifestyles were different from yours. Like, one part of the book that I found sort of, I guess, objectionable from my point of view, although for the most part, everything you said I could have said right on to. There was one part where you were talking about the way lesbians were handling the situation before liberation. And it was obvious, coming from the kind of lifestyle where the two of you had to be in the closet for so many years, that you knew that part of the story inside out.
I know the closet very well. We all do, inside now.
But then you spoke about a group that you called the damned, women whose attitudes were sort of the hell with it. And these were the somebody out there that even I couldn't recognize, that the horror, the monster that they tell you is the people that your parents warned you against. And it didn't sound like really anybody that I knew.
Well, I think what we were trying to talk about is the people that sort of totally accepted all the negative things and sort of live them out. They're supposed to be hopeless and helpless and promiscuous and drunk or bizarre. I think that they want to be good at it in some way and just live out what society thinks of them, because it's kind of a hopeless attitude. And I don't think very many people feel that. It is, it's just the opposite of liberation, really. It's just living out all the worst and not the best in you, which I think other people do too, not just gay people. Some people just, like to explore the you know.
Sort of the Jean Genets of the lesbian world.
Maybe.
Right. Be the death of me. My life, because a maniac to my vein leads to a sinner in my head, and then I'm better off and dead.
That you can't separate this person from the only available environment at that time, which was the worst of the bars. I understand that there has been some improvement, but I think this person has had to have a particular bad down environment in which to exist. And you can't, in fact, this person really, these people, the damned, reacted totally to their environment, and they just ingested what they were told.
I think the bars always promoted that kind of feeling of being forbidden and being sneaky and being, with the red lights in the warehouse districts in the basement with the protection of these, from the police, which maybe all of that wasn't all as necessary as they made it seem, but I think they kind of, and it was very easy to fantasize a real evil criminal underground. If you wanted to play games.
You see, my feeling about that is that I participated to some extent in that. There was a kind of feeling involved in my early participation in the bar scene, which is similar to the feeling I had in some of my political activities.
Danger.
A danger and a kind of attempt at total rebellion against everything that I had been taught was good, therefore choosing everything that was supposed to be bad. And the question was always, how far could you go? And yet, to the extent that I was involved in it, and to the extent that other people I knew were involved in it, there were always certain limits. The people I knew never threw their whole lives into that, because you can't really see yourself completely as the devil or a villain, except for some really psychotic types. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the damned, it sounds like people way out there. When actually I participated in that culture to some extent and found that people only damned themselves about, say, 10% of the time, and the rest of the time did what they had to do to earn a living.
Yeah, well, I think they found some enjoyment in that in some way. But I think that's that whole section of the book you're talking about now, which is the first half, what it was like, was about oppression, which lesbians know very well. So that part is not so much for lesbians as the second part. I think the first part about oppression was for people, and people that say, why are you oppressed? You can get a job. I don't understand anymore. All you have to do is hide. You look like everybody else. And what do you mean by oppression? And I think that in order to explain in some way, these abstract terms like liberation, we wanted to show in somehow what we were trying to get away from, what we couldn't stand, and what started our rebellion. What it really focuses on is the first part of as the external pressures in succumbing to them, really, under oppression, just believing them and the inferiority, the whole bit. And the second part is defying them all and looking inside for the richness in your life instead of externally. So
in a way, this kind of thing is very hard. I know Martha's written articles and essays on. You seem to find a very personal voice in these.
It's interesting because somebody said to me, even though your book isn't written in the first person, they said it's a very personal book.
Well, I think in the stuff that I write, I mean, in a way I can be even more personal because I always write in the first person.
Yeah.
And that's because I'm always writing as myself rather than with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think in your book, there's a combination of things. On one hand, you're being analytical and talking about lesbians in general. And on the other hand, you're telling a story from a first-person point, well, double first-person point of view. Like, for instance, the story about now. I've heard that story from at least 5 different sources and from 5 different points of view, some of whom would agree with you fairly closely. Others would disagree violently, saw it from a whole different perspective.
I'd like to hear the perspective from the other side, because the people you talk to are probably generally approaching it from our point of view.
Well, I heard about it also from the opposition, the people who voted dead against you.
Now, that would be an entirely different story, I admit, and I'm sure it would be, and I'd be interested to hear that story. I think that's an excellent chapter, because it's a very real struggle, piece by piece, event by event, person by person, one section of the country sort of at a time. And I'm glad that the whole thing coalesced positively in California with this a very strong, right-on, supportive, and actually, from their point of view, even apologizing for what they'd done to lesbians, in their resolution, which supported lesbianism.
I guess one of the things I was expecting in the book was more of a comprehensive history in terms of what was going on in the lesbian movement around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed more like you were covering what was going on that you were personal witnesses to in the New York area.
I don't know, maybe people should know something about the publishing world these days or something, but our original agreement to write the book was to write it in 5 months. And we had a good deal of it done at that time. And we thought, this is idiocy, absolute idiocy, because we're going to kind of rush and break our necks, and that's not the way it should be done. So we did wind up taking a year. But that was part of what happened. In other words, if we had had a clear mandate to take a year, this all sounds very grubby, but I think people should know about it. If we'd had a clear mandate to take a year in the beginning, I think we would have written letters to various groups around the country, and we would have tried to bring in more information. As it was, some of the things we talked about were done as case histories of what we did know, and as what we thought, as Barbara said, were examples of what was going on around the country.
Yeah, you see, I guess at the time that you were going through that, I wasn't a member of NOW.
Right, I think that one reason why we didn't focus more on the lesbian movement, even just in New York, was that things were in a very chaotic state and in a state of flux. A lot of very promising, exciting experiments were underway. The Daughters of Bilitis were revising their way of conducting their lives as an organization, and the Radical Lesbians had been born and had shot off like a shooting star, and so somewhere along the line it disappeared out of sight and kind of fragmented themselves. And this, in a way, is almost harder for us to understand as lesbians. In other words, I think you and I rapped about this once in the car, that in a way, the lesbian movement in part exists only somewhat on its own. And some of the things that have been done totally on its own have been, like all movement endeavors, but maybe even more so, quicker and more chaotic, I think very, very productive. I've been thinking a lot about this lately. I mean, I think we've learned much more about ourselves But not all of that we've learned has necessarily been tremendously happy. I think as individuals, I've been very lucky lately to have been in the same place a year later than I've been a year before, the same people, same location. And I notice very beautiful changes in people, very rich and deep changes. But some of our group endeavors have not been as successful in a way, or maybe they were. I mean, maybe they were meant to only be brief. And maybe they were productive in terms of individual people's lives. But it's much harder for me to evaluate that in a way than to evaluate some kind of interface between lesbians and now.
But this is all symbolic for the women's movement. I think it's very important. I wanted that chapter in there, although it's a little different in format from the rest of the chapters, because I want women's liberation women to read this, to know what has been going on in the history of this movement, that they have just most of the people, as we say in there, represented an uninformed constituency. They did not know what was going on, and they were oppressive to lesbians. They did not even know it. I think that they should be in a position to be aware of what's going on. You just can't come into the women's liberation movement now and say there are no lesbians in the movement. And
well, the original thought I had when I brought up the discussion on that particular chapter was that, you know, at the time that this was going on, within the lesbian movement itself, which was more fragmented, and the rest of the women's movement was more fragmented too, because they weren't in the situation of now, being a national organization with a certain comparatively rigid structure.
Well, this is interesting. This just shows where I know we came from different places. See, I started in the women's liberation movement for 2 years before year and a half before gay liberation came about. And Sydney started in women's liberation up at Columbia. So we came about from women's liberation, and when I first heard your name, you were with Gay Liberation Front. And
I started with the OB.
When the two movements came together, I think it was at Rita May's first group consciousness raising groups, where she brought lesbians from now plus from Gay Liberation Front. And that was a pretty historic little meeting, I thought. There were some key people there. Yeah, Red Stockings. And I thought that was the first time I knew in any way of women's liberation and gay liberation coming together in a meaningful way to talk about the issues.
I think that this sort of never seems to die. I mean, at one point when Barbara and I were writing the book, we almost thought that these chapters might even be outdated by the time it's published, but they're not outdated. I don't know, there was a recent article in something like Atlantic Monthly by Midge Dechter, which is one of the most vicious examples of backlash yet. She talks about the frenzied advocates of the clitoris, and she doesn't say lesbian many times. She does a few times, but it's fairly clear that that's in back of a lot of her anger and so forth. And I don't believe that we have really changed the mind of anyone who was firmly against us in the beginning. I mean,
yeah, one of the things, though, that sometimes disheartens me is seeing in the New York Times book review section recently this woman, I think Joan Didion, reading through a whole batch of all of the best women's liberation books and writing a scathingly anti-women's liberation review that went on for 2 pages. And, of course, the male editors chose to put this on the first page of the book review so that everyone who read that book review would read her really anti-feminist hash.
I think this just points up what I was trying to say before about the Midge Dechter article. In view of writing right now, we are in a tremendous period of backlash. It's the worst one, I believe, that the women's movement and lesbians, therefore, too, have undergone. The first round of the backlash was it was some of the same people, like Dechter, but it was also men writing. This time, the bitter and hurtful thing is that it's almost primarily women writing.
Yeah, what do you think of the statement that certain people have advanced, myself included, that, quote, lesbianism is a vanguard position in the women's movement?
Oh. The phrase that kept popping up in my mind, I've thought about that ever since we had that talk in the car. And the phrase that keeps popping up in my mind is when Marie Antoinette said, "Let them eat cake," which I interpret as a political statement in which she was saying, live off your dreams, baby, because that's all you've got. And I think that this is the danger. If it were all if it were all that simple and that rosy, that we could just say we're the avant-garde of the women's movement. We are, and I hope Barbara or someone talks about this politically. I think we are, but I think what we may.